term rising trend and an annual cycle. The cause of the plateau between 1998 and 2008 is yet another uncertainty in climate science. And as with CO2, today's methane concentrations are dramatically higher than those of the past few million years, beginning a sharp rise about 4,000 years ago. But there are several important differences between methane and carbon dioxide. One is that methane concentrations are much lower, 2,000 parts per billion, which is about 1/200th that of CO2's 400 parts per million. Another difference is that a methane molecule lasts in the atmosphere for only about 12 years, though after that, chemical reactions convert it to CO2. And a third difference is that, because of the peculiarities of how molecules interact with the different colors of infrared radiation, every additional methane molecule in the atmosphere is 30 times more potent in warming than a molecule of carbon dioxide. These differences, lower concentration and shorter lifetime, but greater warming potency, must be taken into account when comparing CH4 and CO2 emissions. For instance, the 300 million tons of methane humans emit each year is only 0.8% of the 36 gigatons of CO2 emitted by burning fossil fuels. But as shown in Figure 3.2, that methane has a disproportionate warming influence, equivalent to 10 gigatons of CO2. Figure 3.4. Atmospheric methane concentrations from 1983 to 2020. Monthly average values are shown in parts per billion. The solid line is the 12-month trailing average. One additional point about methane that surprises many people is that fossil fuels account for only about 1/4 of global human-caused methane emissions, as shown in Figure 3.5. Rather, most methane emissions arise from enteric fermentation, digestion in cattle, mostly emitted from the front of the animal, not the back, and other agricultural activities, particularly rice cultivation. The decay of material in landfills is also significant. So any effort to drastically reduce emissions must also address those sources. Future climates will be determined by the climate's response to both human and natural influences, as well as by its internal variability. As we've seen, the climate is quite capable of varying without any help from us. While we've little detailed knowledge, much less control, over internal variability or natural influences, volcanoes, the sun, and deep ocean currents have minds of their own, just like the climate, we can make plausible assumptions about the range of what humans will do, particularly in regard to their emissions of greenhouse gases and aerosols. Future emissions, and hence human influences on the climate, will depend upon future demographics, economic progress, regulation, and the energy and agricultural technologies in use. Various assumptions about each of those can be combined to project greenhouse gas emissions, aerosol concentrations, and changes in land use. Climate models run under these assumptions can give some sense of how the climate might respond to human influences in the coming decades. But it is here that the warning light should start blinking. Despite the certainty with which projections are reported as facts, estimating human influences is a highly uncertain business. Imagine being back in 1900 and trying to project what civilization would be like in the year 2000. At the time, the first powered flight and the first mass-produced automobile were yet to come. Radio had just been invented, and X-rays just discovered, and antibiotics weren't even imagined. Even the most prescient prognosticator back then would have missed most of what transpired in the subsequent century as the global population quadrupled and the global economy grew by a factor of 40. They'd be amazed at the scale and rapidity with which people, goods, and information now move around the globe, at how we manufacture, and at our advances in agriculture and medicine. Because of the great uncertainties about the decades to come, instead of making precise predictions of future concentrations, the IPCC created a set of scenarios. They have the rather complicated name of Representative Concentration Pathways, or RCPs. These are meant to span a plausible range of possibilities for population, economy, technology, and so on. Each RCP has a number indicating the amount of warming human influence expected in 2100 under that scenario, so that RCP 6 corresponds to 6 watts per square meter of human-induced radiative forcing, warming, at the end of the century. Remember, net human influences are currently about 2.2 watts per square meter of warming, as shown in Figure 2.4. These scenarios are not meant to be predictions, but rather are schematic descriptions of distinct but plausible future worlds. the RCPs have since been elaborated into shared socioeconomic pathways that also describe society's ability to reduce emissions and adapt to a changing climate. But the important takeaways can be understood by discussing the simpler RCPs. Historically, two of the most important drivers of emissions have been growing population and growing economic activity. Figure 3.6 shows the assumptions made about these factors in four RCP scenarios. In the low emissions RCP 2.6 scenario, which has 2.6 watts per square meter radiative forcing at century's end, global population grows from today's 7.8 billion to peak at 9 billion in 2070, and then declines by a few hundred million by 2100. At the other extreme, RCP 8.5 assumes that population grows steadily to more than 12 billion in 2100. Global real GDP is assumed to grow strongly through the 21st century in all scenarios, by a factor of 6 in the higher emitting scenarios, but by a factor of 10 in the lower emitting scenarios, presumably because a more prosperous world is able to place a higher priority on environmental matters. Since GDP grows by a larger multiple than population in all scenarios, the world in 2100 is projected to be more prosperous on a per capita, that is, per person, basis in any future, a detail often omitted from discussions of model results. The corresponding RCP assumptions about CO2 emissions, CO2 concentration, and total human-caused radiative forcing are shown in Figure 3.7. The last is the net effect of all human-caused greenhouse gases and aerosols. The diversity of emissions assumptions among the scenarios leads to a similar diversity of human influences on the climate at century's end. As expected, lower emissions lead to lower concentrations, and hence weaker human influence on the climate, forcing. The populous coal-heavy world of RCP 8.5 has annual CO2 emissions more than tripling by century's end, the concentration soaring to more than 900 ppm, and the radiative forcing more than triple what it is today. In contrast, the prosperous low-population world of RCP 2.6 has CO2 emissions vanishing by 2080, so that both the concentration and the forcing stabilize at today's values, declining very slowly afterward. The intermediate emitting scenarios RCP 4.5 and 6.0 show correspondingly intermediate behavior in concentration and forcing. A recent analysis of emissions from 2005 to 2017 shows that high emission scenarios are increasingly implausible because of slower economic growth through 2040 and reduced coal use through the end of the century. A crucial point to take away from this discussion is that human influences will continue to grow in any scenario short of ceasing all emissions. If future emissions are only reduced modestly, human influences on the climate will continue to grow. 15 years ago, when I was in the private sector, I learned to say that the goal of stabilizing human influences on the climate was a challenge, while in government, it was talked about as an opportunity. Now back in academia, I can more forthrightly call it what it is. A practical impossibility, as I'll discuss in this book's part two. There is no question that our emission of greenhouse gases, in particular CO2, is exerting a warming influence on the planet. Human influences on the climate have grown over the past decades and will continue to grow under all but the most radical scenarios for future emissions. Not only are human influences difficult to disentangle from other aspects of the climate system, but the relationship between emissions and atmospheric concentrations makes it very challenging to moderate our influences. When human influences are fed into a model to project a future climate, the results are, at some level, unremarkable. Higher greenhouse gas emissions lead to higher global temperatures sooner. But knowing exactly how much warming would occur, when and where, what other changes there might be in the climate system, and how those changes might actually impact society requires much more sophisticated analysis. This analysis, both how it's done and what it really tells us, is the subject of the next chapter. 4. Many muddled models. You've likely heard about climate models that predict this or that, and no doubt that such models prove this or that as well. But exactly what are climate models? The short answer is that they are computer programs that perform mathematical simulations of the climate system. As University of Wisconsin statistician George Box said famously in 1978, all models are wrong, but some are useful. I have been involved with scientific computing for my entire career. I learned to code more than 50 years ago on an IBM 1620 as a high school sophomore, thanks to a Columbia University science enrichment program. One of my first published papers, in 1974, involved computer modeling of the nuclear reaction in stars that produces the oxygen in the universe. In 1981, an IBM representative unexpectedly showed up in my office. He had a gift for me, one of the first personal computers, and he had only one request, that I do something interesting with it. I eventually developed a course at Caltech on computational physics, that is, computer modeling, and wrote one of the first textbooks on the subject. Even now, almost four decades later, I'm pleased when a researcher tells me how much they learned from the book about how to translate pencil and paper physics into useful simulations. Some of my most widely cited research involved developing and making use of novel algorithms for simulating quantum mechanical systems like the electrons in an atom or the protons and neutrons in a nucleus. And for the past three decades, I have helped guide simulations that give the U.S. confidence in its stockpile of nuclear weapons, even in the absence of exploding nuclear weapons to test them, which is now prohibited by international treaties. This long and varied experience has given me an appreciation for the power of computer models, but also a respect for their limitations. Professor Box's aphorism hits the nail on the head. Computer modeling is central to climate science. The models help us understand how the climate system works, why it has changed in the past, and, most importantly, how it might change in the future. The most recent United Nations assessment report on climate science, AR5-WG1, WG1, you'll remember, standing for Working Group 1, devotes four of its 14 chapters entirely to models and their results. Those results underpin the reports of the other UN working groups that assess the impacts of a changing climate on ecosystems and society. I first learned about the details of climate modeling almost 30 years ago in the course of a JSON study of how the then-new massively parallel computers, which coordinate thousands of processors working on a single problem, might improve the predictive capabilities of climate models. Much of that promise has indeed been realized in the three decades since the study. But there's a big caveat. Usefully describing the Earth's climate remains one of the most challenging scientific simulation problems there is. So, how good are our climate models? And how much confidence should we have in what they say about future climates? To answer those questions, we have to dig a bit deeper into the details. Computing climate. Scientific computers are machines for doing arithmetic. They can store many, many numbers. Today's largest machines are approaching 10 to the 17th, or 100 million billion, and can manipulate them at blinding speed. Today, some 10 to the 18th, or a billion billion, operations per second. Since we have a very solid understanding of the physical laws that govern matter and energy, it's easy to be seduced by the notion that we can just feed the present state of the atmosphere and oceans into a computer, make some assumptions about future human and natural influences, and so accurately predict the climate decades into the future. Unfortunately, that's just a fantasy, as you might infer from weather forecasts, which can be accurate only out to 2 weeks or so. That is better than they were 30 years ago, largely due to more computer power, as well as to improved observations of the atmosphere that provide a more accurate starting point for the models. But the scant 2-week-long accuracy of weather forecasts reflects a fundamental problem described by Ed Lorenz at MIT in 1961. The weather is chaotic. Small changes in how we start the model can lead to very different predictions after a few weeks. So no matter how precisely we might specify current conditions, the uncertainty in our predictions grows exponentially as they extend into the future. More computer power cannot overcome this basic uncertainty. But remember, climate is not weather. Rather, it's the average of weather over decades, and that is what climate models try to describe. There's reason to believe that's possible. After all, while we can't predict with much detail how individual bubbles will arise in a boiling pot of water, we can confidently predict how the average level of the water will decline as a result of all that boiling. Of course, the climate system is a lot more complicated than a boiling pot of water, and a host of vexing practical problems means that climate model results require at least a pinch, if not a pound, of salt. So let's talk about what climate models and climate modelers actually do. All but the simplest computer models of the climate begin by covering the Earth's atmosphere with a three-dimensional grid, typically 10 to 20 layers of grid boxes, stacked above a surface grid of squares that are typically 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers, 60 miles by 60 miles, as shown in Figure 4.1. But because the height of the atmosphere that needs to be modeled is comparable to the size of one surface grid square, the layered boxes atop the grid are much more like pancakes than the cubes shown in the figure. More about that shortly. The grid covering the oceans is similar, but with smaller surface grid squares, typically 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers, 6 miles by 6 miles, and more vertical layers, up to 30. With the entire Earth covered this way, there are about 1 million grid boxes for the atmosphere and 100 million grid boxes for the ocean. Grid in place, the computer models use the fundamental laws of physics to calculate how the air, water, and energy in each box at a given time move to neighboring grid boxes at a slightly later time. This time step can be as small as 10 minutes. Repeating this process millions of times over simulates the climate for a century, just over 5 million times if the time step is 10 minutes. These many time steps in a simulation can take months of computer time on even the world's most powerful supercomputers. The amount depends upon the number of grid boxes and how many time steps are taken, as well as the sophistication of the model's description of what goes on in the grid boxes. It's physics. Researchers can make trade-offs among these different factors depending upon the purpose of the model. For the same amount of computer time, a less sophisticated model can be run with a finer grid and/or to simulate a longer period. Comparing the results of computer runs with what we know about past climates, both the average and year-by-year variations, gives some sense of how good a model is. Once the model is in place, a series of computer runs into the future under assumed human and natural influences then attempt to describe the climate decades hence. This all sounds straightforward, but it's not at all easy. In fact, it's excruciatingly difficult, and anyone who says that climate models are just physics either doesn't understand them or is being deliberately misleading. One major challenge is that the models use only single values of temperature, humidity, and so on to describe conditions within a grid box. Yet many important phenomena occur on scales smaller than the 100-kilometer, 60-mile grid size, such as mountains, clouds, and thunderstorms, and so researchers must make subgrid assumptions to build a complete model. For example, flows of sunlight and heat through the atmosphere are influenced by clouds. They play a key role. Depending upon their type and formation, clouds will reflect sunlight or intercept heat in varying amounts. Physics tells us that the numbers and types of clouds present in each of the layers of atmosphere above a grid square, the stacked boxes, will generally depend upon conditions there, humidity, temperature, and so on. Yet, as illustrated by Figure 4.2, changes and differences in clouds occur on a much smaller scale than that of a grid box, and so assumptions are necessary. While modelers base their subgrid assumptions upon both fundamental physical laws and observations of weather phenomena, there is still considerable judgment involved. And since different modelers will make different assumptions, results can vary widely among models. This is not at all an unimportant detail, since ordinary fluctuations in the height and coverage of clouds can have as much of an impact on flows of sunlight and heat as do human influences. In fact, the greatest uncertainty in climate modeling stems from the treatment of clouds. So why not use a finer grid to make the subgrid assumptions less ambiguous? Unfortunately, that would dramatically increase the size of the computation, most obviously because there would be more grid boxes to deal with. But aside from the number of boxes, a finer grid introduces another complication. Any computation is only accurate if things don't change too much over one time step. That is, don't move more than one grid box. So if the grid is finer, the time step has to be smaller as well, meaning even more computer time will be required. As an illustration, a simulation that takes 2 months to run with 100-kilometer grid squares would take more than a century if it instead used 10-kilometer squares. The runtime would remain at 2 months if we had a supercomputer 1,000 times faster than today's, a capability probably 2 or 3 decades in the future. Another issue arises because of the difference in the way our grid divides the Earth into meaningful chunks, horizontally versus vertically. The atmosphere and ocean are both thin shells covering the Earth's surface. The average ocean depth, 4 kilometers or 2.5 miles, is very small compared to the Earth's radius, 6,400 kilometers or 4,000 miles, as is the height of the relevant atmosphere, about 100 kilometers or 60 miles. To accurately describe vertical variations, the several dozen grid boxes stacked up into the atmosphere above each square, or below it into the ocean, have to be more like very flat pancakes than like cubes, typically some 100 times wider than they are high. For comparison, a dime is only 13 times wider than it is thick. Pancake boxes generally make for a more accurate simulation where the atmosphere is flowing in layers, for example, in the upper parts of the stack. There's a reason the high-altitude atmosphere is called the stratosphere. But these flat boxes become a problem in the atmosphere below 10 kilometers, 6 miles, where turbulent weather happens. Upward flows of energy and water vapor, think thunderhead clouds, occur over areas much smaller than the 100 kilometer, 60 miles, of our grid. This is particularly troublesome in the tropics, where upward flows are important in lofting energy and water vapor from the ocean surface into the atmosphere. In fact, the flow of energy carried into the atmosphere by evaporation of the ocean waters is more than 30 times larger than the human influences shown back in Figure 2.4. So subgrid assumptions about this moist convection, how air and water vapor move vertically through the flat grid boxes, are crucial to building accurate models. Any simulation also needs to be initialized. That is, we need to somehow specify the state of the ocean and atmosphere at the start of the time stepping, the temperature, humidity, winds, etc., in every one of the grid boxes covering the atmosphere, as well as the temperature, salinity, current, etc., in every ocean grid box. Unfortunately, even with our sophisticated observation systems, that kind of detail isn't available today, let alone for decades in the past. And even if it were, the level of chaos in the simulation, remember our discussion of weather prediction, would render most of the details irrelevant after 2 weeks or so. So the initialization needs to correctly capture only the gross features of the climate system, such as the atmosphere's jet stream or the major ocean currents. Even with the grid, the basic physics, the subgrid assumptions, and initialization in hand, we're still not ready to generate a useful climate simulation. The last remaining step is to tune the model. Each subgrid assumption has numerical parameters that have to be set, somehow. Cloud cover and convection are only two examples out of dozens. How much water evaporates from the land surface depending upon the soil properties, plant cover, and atmospheric conditions. How much snow or ice is on the surface. How do ocean waters mix? Subgrid assumptions are inexact by nature because they are, well, subgrid. There isn't a number modelers can take from reality. So modelers set subgrid parameters based on what they know about the physics, and then run their model. Since the results generally don't much look like the climate system we observe, modelers then adjust, tune, these parameters to get a better match with some features of the real climate system. Most important are the near-exact balance between solar heating and infrared cooling we discussed in Chapter 2, and what the surface temperature is, determined by how sunlight and heat flow through the atmosphere. Although tuning sounds like a minor detail, as in fine-tuning, there isn't anything fine or minor about it. It's the process of adjusting the model to deal with troublesome inconsistencies or paper over irksome uncertainties. And sometimes modelers are tuning subgrid parameters in ways that aren't based on their knowledge of the parameter, but rather are aimed at producing a desired result. For example, UK researchers tuned their latest model in part by adjusting how partial snow cover changes the albedo of northern forests. Snow reflects more than treetops. They also chose to adjust how much dimethyl sulfide is produced by microorganisms on the ocean surface. That chemical produces aerosols, and so increases the albedo over the oceans. Who would have thought those details are important to the climate? In any event, it is impossible, for both practical and fundamental reasons, to tune the dozens of parameters so that the model matches the far more numerous observed properties of the climate system. Not only does this cast doubt on whether the conclusions of the model can be trusted, it makes it clear that we don't understand features of the climate to anywhere near the level of specificity required, given the smallness of human influences. Among the most important things that a model has to get right are feedbacks. The growing greenhouse gas concentrations that raise the global temperature can also cause other changes in the climate system that either amplify or diminish their direct warming influence. For example, as the globe gets warmer, there will be less snow and ice on the surface, which decreases the planet's albedo. The less reflective Earth will then absorb more sunlight, causing even more warming. Another example of a feedback is that as the atmosphere warms, it will hold more water vapor, which further enhances its heat intercepting ability. But more water vapor will also change the cloud cover, enhancing both heat interception, high clouds, and reflectivity, low clouds. On balance, the reflectivity wins, and the net cloud feedback somewhat diminishes the direct warming. The size, or in some cases even the sign, of these feedback effects, that is, whether they enhance or diminish the direct influence, cannot be understood precisely enough from first principles, but must emerge from a model as it's tuned, and each model will give somewhat different answers. The average of results over many different models suggests that the net effect of all feedbacks is to double or triple CO2's direct warming influence. So tuning is a necessary, but perilous, part of modeling the climate, as it is in modeling of any complex system. An ill-tuned model will be a poor description of the real world, while overtuning risks cooking the books, that is, predetermining the answer. A paper co-authored by 15 of the world's leading climate modelers put it this way: choices and compromises made during the tuning exercise may significantly affect model results. In theory, tuning should be taken into account in any evaluation, intercomparison, or interpretation of the model results. Why such a lack of transparency? This may be because tuning is often seen as an unavoidable but dirty part of climate modeling, more engineering than science, an act of tinkering that does not merit recording in the scientific literature. There may also be some concern that explaining that models are tuned may strengthen the arguments of those claiming to question the validity of climate change projections. Tuning may be seen indeed as an unspeakable way to compensate for model errors. Indeed, a paper laying out the details of one of the most esteemed models, that of Germany's Max Planck Institute, tells of tuning a subgrid parameter, related to convection in the atmosphere, by a factor of 10 because the originally chosen value resulted in twice as much warming as had been observed. Changing a subgrid parameter by a factor of 10 from what you thought it was, that's really dialing the knob. A range of results. By now, you should have a pretty clear picture of how the models come to be, and why any glimpse they offer of the future might be less clear than we'd like. But let's have a look at the results. Because no one model will get everything right, the assessment reports average results from an ensemble made up of a few dozen different models from research groups around the world. The Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, otherwise known as CMIP, compiles the ensembles. Its CMIP-3 ensemble informed the IPCC's AR4 report, while CMIP-5 underpinned the 2013 AR5 report, and CMIP-6 will be the basis for the upcoming AR6 assessment. But here we need to pause. The implication is that the models generally agree, but that isn't at all the case. Comparisons among models within any of these ensembles show that, on the scales required to measure the climate's response to human influences, model results differ dramatically both from each other and from observations. But you wouldn't know that unless you read deep into the IPCC report. Only then would you discover that the results being presented are averaging models that disagree wildly with each other. By the way, the discordance among the individual ensemble members is further evidence that climate models are more than just physics. If they weren't, multiple models wouldn't be necessary, as they'd all come to virtually the same conclusions. One particularly jarring failure is that the simulated global average surface temperature, not the anomaly, varies among models by about 3 degrees Celsius, 5.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 times greater than the observed value of the 20th century warming they're purporting to describe and explain. And 2 models whose average surface temperatures differ by that much will vary considerably in their details. For example, since you're not allowed to tune the freezing temperature of water, as it's determined by nature, the amounts of snow and ice cover, and hence the albedos, might be very different. The assessment reports downplay this embarrassment of unphysical average temperatures by focusing on the rise in the average temperature and displaying the temperature changes calculated by each model, rather than the temperatures themselves. This makes differences among the ensemble members less apparent. The result is Figure 4.3, adapted from the AR5 report. This graph looks at the global average surface temperature anomaly, comparing the averages and spreads of the ensembles used in AR4 and AR5 with the observed values, the information we encountered back in Figure 1.1. The agreement of the ensemble averages with the observations looks impressive, but these results need to be taken with some of that salt I mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. One of the world's most accomplished climate modelers has said that it's reasonable to assume that there has been some tuning, implicit if not explicit, in models that fit the temperature history well. And the details of Figure 4.3 reveal a few other problems. One stunning problem is that the spread of the CMIP5 ensemble in the years after 1960 is larger than that of the models in CMIP3. In other words, the later generation of models is actually more uncertain than the earlier one. So here is a real surprise. Even as the models became more sophisticated, including finer grids, fancier subgrid parameterizations, and so on, the uncertainty increased rather than decreased. Having better tools and information to work with should make the models more accurate and more in line with each other. That this has not happened is something to keep in mind whenever you read "models predict." The fact that the spread in their results is increasing is as good evidence as any that the science is far from settled. But another equally serious issue is also illustrated here. Figure 4.3 shows that the ensembles fail to reproduce the strong warming observed from 1910 to 1940. On average, the models give a warming rate over that period of about half what was actually observed. As the IPCC noted in measured and somewhat antiseptic language, it remains difficult to quantify the contribution to this warming from internal variability, natural forcing, and anthropogenic forcing, due to forcing and response uncertainties and incomplete observational coverage. More bluntly, they're saying that we've no idea what causes this failure of the models. They cannot tell us why the climate changed during those decades. And that's deeply unsettling, because the observed early 20th century warming is comparable to the observed late 20th century warming, which the assessment reports attribute with high confidence to human influences. That internal variability the IPCC refers to as a difficult-to-quantify contributor, as though a minor issue, is in fact a big problem. Climate observations clearly show repeating behaviors over decades, and even centuries. At least some of these are due to slow changes in ocean currents and the interaction between the ocean and the atmosphere. The best-known example is that of El Niño events, technically the El Niño Southern Oscillation, a shift in heat across the equatorial Pacific Ocean that occurs irregularly every 2 to 7 years and influences global weather patterns. A slower behavior that's less well known is the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, AMO, which involves cyclic temperature changes in the North Atlantic. Figure 4.4 shows that the strength of the AMO, as inferred from sea surface temperatures, repeats over 60 to 80 year cycles. The Pacific Ocean shows a similar, though unrelated, cyclic behavior known as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, PDO, which has a cycle length of about 60 years. Because we have only about 150 years of good observations, systematic behaviors that occur over longer timescales are less well known. There could be, and almost certainly are, other natural cyclic variations occurring over even longer periods. Cycles like these influence global and regional climates, and are superimposed upon any trends due to human or natural forcings like greenhouse gas emissions or volcanic aerosols. They make it difficult to determine which observed changes in the climate are due to human influences and which are natural. For example, the spikes in the global temperature anomaly during 1998 and 2016, as shown in Figure 1.1, are due to especially large El Niño events. While today's models can reproduce some aspects of El Niño events, they aren't very good at reproducing the strength, duration, pattern on the globe, or timing of slower cycles. The AR5 reported that, while a number of models do produce something like the AMO, their versions of this phenomenon differed from model to model and from observations in many respects. Most notably, the timescales for the AMO-like cycle produced by the models ranged from 40 years to a century or more. The models were not any better at reproducing the multi-decadal variability in the Pacific Basin. And the CMIP6 models that inform the IPCC's upcoming AR6 don't perform any better than those of CMIP5, at least by these measures. Figure 4.5 compares temperature anomaly results for the CMIP6 models and observations, much as Figure 4.3 did for the CMIP3 and CMIP5 ensembles. An analysis of 267 simulations run by 29 different CMIP6 models created by 19 modeling groups around the world shows that they do a very poor job of describing warming since 1950 and continue to underestimate the rate of warming in the early 20th century. The failure of even the latest models to warm rapidly enough in the early 20th century suggests that it's possible, even likely, that internal variability, the natural ebbs and flows of the climate system, has contributed significantly to the warming of recent decades. That the models can't reproduce the past is a big red flag. It erodes confidence in their projections of future climates. In particular, it greatly complicates sorting out the relative roles of natural variability and human influences in the warming that has occurred since 1980. A common measure of how the climate system responds to human influences, and an important piece of information we hope to learn from models, is the equilibrium climate sensitivity, or ECS. That's how much the average surface temperature anomaly, recall that the anomaly is the deviation from the expected average, would increase if the CO2 concentration were hypothetically doubled from its pre-industrial value of 280 ppm. If emissions continue at their current pace and the carbon cycle doesn't change much, that doubling would happen in the real world toward the end of this century. The higher the ECS, i.e., the larger the predicted temperature increase, the more sensitive the climate is to human influences, or at least to increased CO2. The National Academy's Charney Report gave a benchmark estimate of the climate sensitivity in 1979. That blue ribbon panel estimated the ECS to be in the range of 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 to 8.1 degrees Fahrenheit, with a most likely value of 3 degrees Celsius, 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit. In 2007, the IPCC's AR4 narrowed the likely range, 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, or 3.6 to 8.1 degrees Fahrenheit, but gave the same most likely value. 7 years later, AR5 reverted to the 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius range, and it gave no most likely estimate. So in 2014, we were no more certain of how sensitive the climate is than we were in 1979. The IPCC's AR6 will rely on the CMIP6 model ensemble. Figure 4.6 shows the ECS values from the 40 of those models for which data was available as of May 2020. About one-third of the models, those shown in black, result in simulated climates that are more sensitive than the likely upper limit of 4.5 degrees Celsius, 8.1 degrees Fahrenheit, given previously by the IPCC. The more sensitive models also warm more rapidly than the observations in recent decades and are inconsistent with paleoclimate data. These higher sensitivities seem to arise from these models' subgrid representations of clouds and their interaction with aerosols. As one of the lead researchers said, "Cloud-aerosol interactions are on the bleeding edge of our comprehension of how the climate system works, and it's a challenge to model what we don't understand. These modelers are pushing the boundaries of human understanding, and I am hopeful that this uncertainty will motivate new science." In other words, we don't really understand an influence on the climate system that's about the same size as the human-caused warming influence. It will be interesting to see how, or whether, the upcoming AR6 report addresses this. We shouldn't be too comforted by those CMIP6 models whose sensitivities are more in line with the older ones, either. Consider this from the Max Planck Institute modelers. We have documented how we tuned the MPI ESM 1.2 global climate model to match the instrumental record warming, an endeavor which has clearly been successful. Due to the historical order of events, the choice was to do this practically by targeting an ECS of about 3 Kelvin, 3 degrees Celsius, using cloud feedbacks, as opposed to tuning the aerosol forcing. In other words, the researchers tuned their model to make its sensitivity to greenhouse gases what they thought it should be. Talk about cooking the books. One of the reasons the climate sensitivity is so uncertain is that aerosols currently exert a cooling influence that partially offsets, or masks, the greenhouse gas warming. That's evident in Figure 4.7, which shows how the global temperature anomalies of the CMIP6 ensemble behave when the simulations are run with different forcings in place. Greenhouse gases alone caused a warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, from 1900, which is partially offset by a cooling of about 0.6 degrees Celsius, 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit, from human-caused aerosols. Solar variation and volcanic aerosols don't have much long-term effect. The curve labeled historical corresponds to the ensemble with all forcings, natural and human-caused, in place. You can see the cooling impact of especially large volcanic eruptions, especially Agung in 1963 and Pinatubo in 1991. The absence of the observed warming from 1910 to 1940 is also evident in the historical simulations. Because of this large but uncertain cooling by aerosols, a model with high sensitivities to both aerosols and greenhouse gases could describe the historical record about as well as one with much lower sensitivities. As the influence of greenhouse gases grows and becomes dominant in the coming decades, aerosols are a significant source of local air pollution, and reducing them is a priority everywhere, ECS estimates could become more precise. A very different way of estimating the climate sensitivity is to compare the temperature rise over the past 140 years with the human and natural forcings that have occurred. For example, comparing the roughly 1 degree Celsius of temperature rise since 1900, shown in Figure 1.1, with the roughly 2 watts per square meter increase in total forcing over that same period, shown in Figure 2.4, gives some estimate of how sensitive the climate is to external influences. This kind of top-down approach is far simpler and more transparent than the detailed grid-based models, no supercomputer required. But it has its own challenges. Apart from uncertainties in temperatures, and in both human and natural influences, there's internal variability to consider, as well as a lag in the response of the temperature to forcing. The oceans are slow to warm. Once these factors are accounted for, however, sensitivities obtained from such energy budget analyses are significantly lower, values of about 1.5 degrees Celsius, than the values from the CMIP ensembles. A 20-author paper published in July 2020 combined the top-down and grid-based approaches, together with some observational and paleo information, in an attempt to pin down the climate sensitivity. The authors found a likely range for the ECS of 2.6 to 4.1 degrees Celsius. This is half that estimated by the AR5, 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, meaning that extremely low or extremely high values are deemed less likely. There's still much work to do to understand just how sensitive the climate system is to various influences. It would be a big deal if the climate were much less, or much more, sensitive than is currently supposed. So there's a lot to fret about in the climate modeling business. Apart from the computational challenge of simulations that can take months to run on even the world's fastest computers, there's the ambiguity in tuning, ill-quantified natural variability, and intricacies like the trade-off between greenhouse gas warming and aerosol cooling to contend with. No wonder we've got a poor understanding of how the climate will respond to rising greenhouse gas concentrations. The more we learn about the climate system, the more we realize how complicated it is. It's uncommon for the popular media to discuss how problematic our climate models are, but you can sometimes get a glimpse of it if you're paying attention. For example, climate models are also used to assess the effects of various climate response strategies, such as deliberately enhancing the Earth's reflectivity, its albedo, to counteract greenhouse gas warming. Such geoengineering is discussed in Chapter 14. A recent National Academies report noted, The uncertainties in modeling of both climate change and the consequences of albedo modification make it impossible today to provide reliable, quantitative statements about relative risks, consequences, and benefits of albedo modification to the Earth's system as a whole, let alone benefits and risks to specific regions of the planet. If the uncertainties in modeling mean these models can't give us useful information about what albedo modification might do, it's hard to see why they would be any better at predicting the response to other human influences. After all, these are the same models discussed in this chapter, with only minor modifications, say making the sun 1% less intense, or adding a bit more aerosol in the upper atmosphere, to simulate the change in albedo. Yet it's difficult to imagine a statement like the one above, except about greenhouse gases instead of albedo modification. Here's what it might say. The uncertainties in modeling of both climate change and the consequences of future greenhouse gas emissions make it impossible today to provide reliable, quantitative statements about relative risks and consequences and benefits of rising greenhouse gases to the Earth system as a whole, let alone to specific regions of the planet. I don't think you'll ever see a statement like that in the assessment reports. As the reports themselves always note, the models are the best we've got, and they are becoming more sophisticated all the time. But for now, they're still beset by myriad problems, and I, along with everyone else, sure wish they were better. 5. Hyping the heat. Today, TV weather presenters have morphed into climate and weather presenters, blaming a broken climate for many of the severe weather events that they cover. Indeed, it has become de rigueur for the media, politicians, and even some scientists to implicate human influences as the cause of heat waves, droughts, floods, storms, and whatever else the public fears. It's a pretty easy sell. The on-the-scene reporting is powerful and often moving, and our poor memories of past events can make unprecedented quite convincing. But the science tells a different story. Observations extending back over a century indicate that most types of extreme weather events don't show any significant change, and some such events have actually become less common or severe, even as human influences on the climate grow. In general, there are high levels of uncertainty involved in detecting trends in extreme weather. Here are some, perhaps surprising, summary statements from the IPCC's AR5-WG1 report, indicating what we know, or don't know, about a few such trends. Low confidence regarding the sign of trend in the magnitude and/or frequency of floods on a global scale. Low confidence in a global scale observed trend in drought or dryness, lack of rainfall, since the middle of the 20th century. Low confidence in trends in small-scale severe weather phenomena such as hail and thunderstorms. Confidence in large-scale changes in the intensity of extreme extratropical cyclones, storms, since 1900, is low. There are many reasons for science's generally low confidence in detecting changes in extreme weather events and then attributing them to human influences, all of which we've discussed earlier. Short and low-quality historical records, high natural variability, confounding natural influences, and disagreements among the many models used. Yet even though we've little evidence of much changing, the media maintains a flow of news connecting weather events to climate, in part by relying on what are called event attribution studies, which have become a growing branch of climate science. Here's how attribution studies work. After some extreme weather event, such as a storm or flood or drought or heat wave, researchers combine climate modeling and historical observations to attempt to determine the role human influences, usually warming, played in its occurrence or severity. Anytime you see an article after a hurricane or similar claiming that climate change, by which the authors mean human-caused climate change, made the event XX percent more likely or YY percent more severe, you're seeing the results of an attribution study. As might be expected, attribution studies almost always focus on weather disasters, not benign weather occurrences. By this point, I probably need hardly tell you that such studies are rife with issues. Many factors contribute to extreme events, and teasing out the result of human influences in any one event is surely a challenge. The executive summary of Chapter 3 of IPCC's 2012 Special Report on Extreme Events, SREX, states the problem well. Many weather and climate extremes are the result of natural climate variability, including phenomena such as El Niño, and natural decadal or multi-decadal variations in the climate provide the backdrop for anthropogenic, human-caused, climate changes. Even if there were no anthropogenic changes in climate, a wide variety of natural weather and climate extremes would still occur. The World Meteorological Organization goes even further, saying, "Any single event, such as a severe tropical cyclone, hurricane, or typhoon, cannot be attributed to human-induced climate change, given the current status of scientific understanding." Practitioners argue that event attribution studies are the best climate science can do in terms of connecting weather to changes in climate. But as a physical scientist, I'm appalled that such studies are given credence, much less media coverage. A hallmark of science is that conclusions get tested against observations. But that's virtually impossible for weather attribution studies. It's like a spiritual advisor who claims her influence helped you win the lottery, after you've already won it. The only way to test that extraordinary claim would be to play the lottery many times with her help, no doubt at considerable cost, and see if you win more than expected. Data is the touchstone of science. The only solid way to test weather event attribution is to see whether the statistical properties of extreme events have changed, which would eliminate the need for attribution studies in the first place. The bottom line is that the science says that most extreme weather events show no long-term trends that can be attributed to human influences on the climate. What models might project for future extremes is quite a different matter, though it's often conflated with what the observational record shows. Yet the popular perception that extreme events are becoming more common and more severe remains. This is not solely the result of the increased prevalence of event attribution studies, or even of the media garbling the message. It is also due to the failure of the official assessment reports to be transparent, or occasionally even correct, about what the science actually says. In the next few chapters, we'll discuss the specific evidence for several phenomena, some extreme weather events among them, commonly attributed to human-caused climate change. In this chapter, we'll begin with a topic that offers an illuminating look at how the disconnect between the popular perception of weather extremes and the science involved arises. While only a small piece of climate science, it illustrates many of the problems in how the science is portrayed to non-experts, including contrived analyses, misrepresentation of results, failure of review processes, and media exaggeration. It's a topic that garners a great deal of attention. Record temperatures. We can all agree the globe has gotten warmer over the past several decades. Here's another summary statement from the IPCC's AR5. Since about 1950, it is very likely that the numbers of cold days and nights have decreased and the numbers of warm days and nights have increased. There is medium confidence that globally the length and frequency of warm spells, including heat waves, has increased since the middle of the 20th century. The science pointing to longer or more frequent warm spells like heat waves inspires a lukewarm, medium confidence, but that of a general trend toward warmer temperatures gets the IPCC's very likely designation, meaning there is a mere 10% chance of it being mistaken. Yet the public perception that extreme high temperatures are on the rise, fostered by headlines like "Daily temperature records run rampant as the globe roasts," is simply incorrect. In the U.S., which has the world's most extensive and highest quality weather data, record low temperatures have indeed become less common, but record daily high temperatures are no more frequent than they were a century ago. Headlines about record highs, often accompanied by visuals of red thermometers and barren desert vistas, don't come out of nowhere, however. The U.S. government's most recent assessment report, the 2017 Climate Science Special Report, CSSR, is not just misleading on this point, it's wrong. I say that, to use the assessment report's lingo, with very high confidence because of some sleuthing I did in the spring of 2019. What emerged is a disturbing illustration of how non-experts are misled and science is spun to persuade, not inform. In fact, page 19 of the CSSR's executive summary says, prominently and with very high confidence, "There have been marked changes in temperature extremes across the contiguous United States. The number of high temperature records set in the past two decades far exceeds the number of low temperature records." It offers Figure 5.1, their figure ES.5 in support. The darker bars show a year in which there were more record highs than lows, while the lighter bars show years in which there were more record lows than highs. The height of the bar indicates the ratio of record highs to record lows for each year. For example, a ratio of 2.1 for a light bar means that the stations had twice as many record daily lows that year as they had record daily highs. I suspect that most readers were shocked by that figure, as I was when I first saw it. Who wouldn't be? An attention-grabbing title, record warm daily temperatures are occurring more often, backed up by data with a hockey stick shape veering sharply upward in recent years, and in the original, years with more highs portrayed in an alarming scarlet. It sure looks like temperatures are going through the roof. But I was disturbed by an apparent inconsistency between that figure and some others deeper in the report, particularly the figure reproduced as our figure 5.2. It shows that the average coldest temperature of the year has clearly increased since 1900, while the average warmest temperature has hardly changed over the last 60 years and is about the same today as it was in 1900. If you look at the graph of highest temperatures in the right-hand panel below, you can also see the warm 1930s of the Dust Bowl, when agricultural practices such as overplowing of greatly expanded cropland in the Great Plains enhanced natural variability. Of course, these average annual record temperatures are not the same thing as the daily record temperatures at individual stations used to construct Figure 5.1, but it sure seemed possible that the ratio of record highs to record lows shown in Figure 5.1 goes up not because record highs are becoming more common, but because as the coldest temperatures warm, the ratio's denominator, number of daily record colds, is getting smaller, while its numerator, number of daily record warms, has hardly changed in recent decades. Inconsistencies are red meat to a scientist. Resolving them can lead to major insights, and I was determined to get to the bottom of this one. To do that, I first looked up the research papers describing how the CSSR determined the incidence of daily temperature extremes. Those papers described a method that counts running records, tallying a record daily high for a given station and a given day of the year if the high temperature that day exceeds that of all prior years. Similarly, a record low is tallied if the low temperature is less than the low of that day in all prior years. This is the sort of record that's announced in your daily weather reports. But there's another way of counting records, as illustrated for high temperatures in Figure 5.3. For a given station on a given day of the year, a running record high temperature occurs in any year where the maximum temperature exceeds that of all the years before it. So there are many of these records over a period of observation. For instance, in Figure 5.1, the period from 1930 to the present. In contrast, an absolute record high temperature occurs only once over the period of observation, in the year that has the highest daily maximum temperature. I quickly understood that there's a big problem with running records. They tend to become less frequent as the years go on, because each new record raises the bar and makes it more difficult to achieve a subsequent record. Think about it. 2 years in from the start of the period of observation, a daily temperature only had to be higher than that in 1930 and 1931 to be a record high. In 1980, to be a record high, the temperature would have to be higher than any on that day over the past 50 years. And in fact, the decline in the number of running records is shown in Figure 5.4, which appears in a reference cited by the CSSR. The black line shows the expected decline even if there were no trend in the data. For instance, if the lowest temperatures weren't warming, the yearly incidence of running records, the dots, would be expected to align closely with that descending curve. If low temperatures were strongly cooling, on the other hand, they would tend to be above the curve. As you can see, the numbers of record highs and lows both declined precipitously between 1930 and the present day, with the number of lows declining more rapidly, explaining why the ratio of record highs to record lows is larger in recent years, even as both types of records are becoming much less frequent. But there's another problem with CSSR's ratio graph, our figure 5.1. The method of running records guarantees that it will show a flat trend in early years, followed by dramatic fluctuations later on. To see that, think about the second year, 1931, of the analysis. On each of the year's 365 days, each station that records a temperature even a degree higher than that of the year before will tally a record high, while those with a temperature lower will not. We'll suppose that the CSSR used 1,400 stations. It doesn't say exactly how many were used, but the 2016 analysis used 1,408. Because of the low bar to a record and the random fluctuations of temperature variations, about half the stations will fall on either side of the previous year's temperature, so that 255,500 record warms, 365 times 1,400 divided by 2, will be tallied that year. Similarly, about the same number of record colds will be tallied, so that the ratio of record warms to record colds in 1931, and in the years soon after, will be close to 1. Because these numbers are large, and will remain so in the early years, the ratio won't vary much from 1 to 1 earlier in the period of observation. However, in later years, as the bar to a new record increases, the numbers of records become much smaller, and so the ratio fluctuates much more. The upshot is that by using the running records method, the ratio graph is guaranteed to show a long period of values around 1 at the start of the record, followed by dramatic variations toward the end, creating the impression of large changes in recent decades, even if they aren't present. While it produces a scary visual, this ratio has almost nothing to do with how temperatures are actually changing. Having understood that the CSSR presentation of U.S. daily record temperatures was badly misleading, I naturally wanted to know what a proper analysis, one using absolute records, would show. I was also interested to see what was happening with record temperatures before 1930, since U.S. temperature observations were certainly available even before 1900. To answer those questions myself, I would have had to start from scratch, download a great quantity of U.S. weather station data, clean it up, and write code to analyze the data. But an advantage in having a wide network of scientific acquaintances is that I can almost always find someone who can do an analysis more quickly, and better, than I could myself. I contacted Professor John Christie at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, whom I had met when he participated in the 2014 APS workshop. John has access to a vast trove of U.S. meteorological records and is adept at analyzing them in different ways. In short order, he was on the case.